We have one case for submission at 10 o'clock, and I'll have it called here in just a second, but for purposes of argument, I need to identify who the panel is, and the panel consists of me. I am Wade Birdwell, Justice Wade Birdwell. To my left is the Honorable Ruben Gonzalez, who is sitting by designation from the 432nd District Court here in Tarrant County. And to my right, my colleague here, is Justice Brian Walker. So you get called Justice today, I think, isn't that right?
I don't think I'm right there yet.
I don't know. I don't know.
We'll call you Justice.
We'll just call you. Anyway, so the matter is ready for submission, so let's go ahead and call the case, please.
The court will now call in the estate of Susan
May it please the court, Justices sure. Birdwell, Walker, Judge/Justice today, Justice Gonzalez. My name is Byron Henry, and along with Walker Young, we'll be representing the appellant in today's case, Mr. Trevor Turnbow, discussing a sanctions order that was issued by the probate court, Judge Brooke Allen. Before I get started, I just wanted to say that dealing with pro ses can be difficult for judges. Sometimes judges have to show the patience of Job, and in this case, having been involved as Mr. Turnbow's counsel for almost a year now, having gotten involved after these events took place, things have gone rather smoothly. We've resolved most of the rest of the case. Judge Brooke Allen has been stellar in dozens and dozens and dozens of probate orders and in dealing with the pro se. And if you look back in the record, there's some other issues I don't think that are relevant today, but we can talk about them if your honors are interested. But in this case, we have one order.
Mr. Henry, you said something that's been, as I've reviewed the case before you began, what is the procedural history? Has this case been resolved in the probate court at this time?
Well, like a lot of probate matters, I'm not sure they ever get resolved. It's like Jarndyce from Bleak House. But in this case, we actually have a settlement agreement, and we are wrapping up the receivership. And with Ms. Lindauer's help, we are working on resolution. But there was a mediated settlement agreement you may have seen in the record, and then there's also a follow-up settlement agreement when that kind of broke down. But basically, this was carved out of that agreement, so we have to deal with this issue separately as it was not part of the resolution by the parties, and it was already on appeal when we reached that agreement. So there are some still things going on. I don't want to make you sound like the case is closed. It certainly is not. There's an open receivership. We'd like to get closed and things like that, but this is really something that we carved out of the settlement agreement to resolve with the court because we couldn't make it a part of the settlement agreement.
Okay, you understand we still have to figure out jurisdiction, though. What is the discrete phase of the estate process that this sanction order renders this sanction order final and appealable?
Well, I think there's two answers. I know your honors expressed questions about the jurisdiction and decided to proceed. I don't think you ruled on the merits of that question, but decided to proceed.
We have not, but that's why I'm asking the question.
I would say of that there's two issues there. One is the discrete phase with respect to the cease and desist order. The cease and desist order is a separate matter that dealt with a conduct by a litigant, pro se litigant, that has been dealt with by a couple of orders preceding this one. This is the third order, I believe, in the line of those.
But this is not, you're not actually appealing the cease and desist order
that
or the $25,000 sanction that was awarded as a basis.
There was a subsequent $100,000 award.
I understand.
Award.
We're here sure. on the 100, but yes. There was an original 25, and my understanding of your appeal is you're not appealing the propriety of the cease and desist order.
That's correct, Your Honor. We are appealing the trial court's finding after an evidentiary hearing that Mr. Turnbow, the appellant here, violated it 10 times and for a variety of procedural issues with the order. And that is, we believe this order is the culmination and the completion of the cease and disorder issue for two reasons. One, there's nothing else follow-up. There's no follow-up on this issue except for collection. And the court had already entered into collection.
Is there a specific cease and desist statute in the estate code? Or, again, we only have jurisdiction if the estate code says we have jurisdiction interlocutorily, okay? And the fact that there was some conduct involved with regard to the trial court addressing conduct, okay, it still has to be associated with a specific discrete phase that's identified by the estate code, not simply because, well, gee, the order was final at the time. That doesn't get us there. So, again, and maybe I interrupted you when you were about to get to it, but, again, what phase were you in when this conduct was addressed, and how did it conclude, and on what basis was it related to that for purposes of appeal?
So I take the case law that we cited in our letter to mean two things. One, there are specific statutorily based orders that's a non-issue. The statutes give you authority as a court to hear those interlocutory in the middle of their exceptions to the one final judgment rule. And then there is the phase of the proceeding, which is a separate basis for jurisdiction under the probate code when there's discrete phases of the proceeding that have begun and concluded. In this case, the probate case is still open, so there's no doubt there. The court should know that the case is still open, so there's not been a final order closing the case. In fact, the receivership phase, which is a phase by which the receiver took control of the property and is exercising control of it both under rules and an MSA to manage the properties until the case is over, is still proceeding. So that is that phase of the proceeding, I guess, which is the management and control of the estate properties, is a phase, and it is still proceeding. And I think some orders in that phase could have been appealed interlocutory because they were distinct orders, but that's not what we're here on. This is a separate issue that is separate and apart from the phase of the receivership or management of the property, and it is basically a carve-out of conduct by a pro se litigant that could, we believe, be encapsulated in what's before Your Honor. There's a cease and desist order and two sanctions orders with related to that order, which have already proceeded to collection because the court included a collection order having the money to be deducted from the money that's in the registry of the court that was owned by Mr. Terma. So everyone...
Is that actually paid from the registry of the court
already? I don't know if it was...
Or is it just a credit or a debt that's being countered against the estate corpus that will be dealt with at the conclusion of the disposition of the corpus?
So, yes, Your Honor. Justice Birdwell, I don't believe it's been paid out of the registry to date. The court's order is... I believe, based on the case law, should be to be disposed of at the end of the case. Otherwise, you create a situation where you have no adequate remedy by appeal and you have to mandamus and go up early because the payment's issued before you could ever appeal it, and so the sanction gets paid. In this case, I don't believe it's been paid, but it's been ordered.
Why should we not, since this $100,000 is in the same posture as the $25,000, that your client can't afford to pay the $25,000, therefore... There was a motion to pay the judgment in the manner that we've just been talking about, the 25 coming out of the corpus of the estate. Why should we not be waiting until that actually occurs when the actual final disposition of the estate occurs? In other words, it's associated with something down the road, but you're here now.
I'm not sure it's associated with something down the road. If the court reads the orders as they're written, the court it is a sanction of $100,000 as well as the $25,000, but it's ordered to be paid from the registry of the court, which in the cases we cited and looked at, sanctions orders or other orders for payment of money along with collections can be appealable, and we consider that the discrete phase of this case.
Okay.
Prudentially, I don't know that, Your Honor, I don't have a good answer for why shouldn't you wait, except that if I don't appeal and then Your Honors later say this was a discrete phase, it was in collection, there was nothing else for the court to do, it was ordered collected from the registry, so there's no more action.
Well, I'm assuming if there's a final judgment disposing of the corpus and $125,000 of the corpus is taken away from your client in that final disposition, that would be an appealable order at that point in time, and you would appeal it if you had a problem with it at that point in time. I'm trying to figure out the interlocutory aspect of this appeal, but I think we've handled that. Any additional questions with regard to jurisdiction?
Yep.
So you need to get to the merits.
The only one that I can think of is, I'm prepared for two oral arguments today, and I read both appellee and appellant's brief. Now I can't remember. Was it you that pointed out that this was not, it was simply just sanctions, it was not contempt, or was that the other side? I don't know, but that is correct. Really what you're appealing is not a contempt order, it's simply sanctions for not following the cease and desist order. Is that correct?
I believe it could be characterized as contempt in the way that it is simply a punishment. I think the other side has conceded that it is simply a penalty or a fine for not complying. It is not sanctions in a restitutionary manner. It wasn't fees or costs or expenses tied to anything anyone incurred. But, yes, it was tailored as sanctions. It was given as sanctions. Everyone has treated it as a sanction order, though it is a penalty or a fine, so to speak. It is still, I believe, a sanctions order and not a finding of contempt, because that's what the order says, and that's the way Judge Allen characterized it. So I would agree with that, Justice Walker.
Okay, on the merits, why was it improper for the trial judge to consider the filing of additional lawsuits to fit within the exception that she created in the cease and desist order so that he could communicate with the exact people she had forbidden him to communicate? So let's just go sue them, and then that creates the litigation exception. He literally, his conduct is creating the exception she recognized. Why was that improper for her to find as an abuse of her order?
Well, it doesn't violate the cease and desist order, first and foremost. They're separate rules.
Why would it not violate the spirit of her order?
I don't know.
In other words, the lawsuit's communication. It's served on it's communication. That would, the creation of the lawsuit before you get into the lawsuit, it's a communication. Why would it not do that?
If you construe the order to be sort of like an anti-suit injunction in addition to a cease and desist order, like you can't sue, there's been no, that would raise many more appellate issues with respect to the vexatious litigant statute and the requirements for an anti-suit injunction. I don't think anyone has characterized it as such, and I'm not sure Judge Allen did. Well, if you look at the calculations, it seems like she was basing her ruling, if you just read the reporter's record, even though it's not in the order, on continued communications, even though the motion that was filed for sanctions only alleges three lawsuits and one communication. The court found 10. I think that's also problematic under the case law that kind of limits what a court can find.
Softball, what jurisdiction did Judge Allen have over communications in another court?
Well, that was with respect to Chapter 10, 9, and 13, which govern filing of frivolous lawsuits. Most of the case law say, absent an anti-suit injunction, only the court in which those cases are filed has jurisdiction to determine whether or not those are frivolous lawsuits. So vexatious litigant is an exception, of course, and so is an anti-suit injunction, where a trial judge issues that order and you violate it by filing another lawsuit. That court has kind of usurped jurisdiction over your conduct, but that didn't happen in this case. Of course, none of the prerequisites for either vexatious litigant or anti-suit injunction were filed. And that isn't how this order has been treated, I don't believe, by the court or by the appellee in briefing or by us. So we did not brief it as a prohibition on filing additional litigation in other courts or this court for that matter with respect to his conduct. It was basically a communication that wasn't relevant to ongoing litigation. And to be frank, the prior sanctions motion in which Mr. Turnbow was sanctioned for conduct leading all the way up until October 2, 2020, included communications which were not relevant to any ongoing litigation. So that was dealt with in a prior motion, and Judge Allen found that he had harassed and violated the cease and desist order and ordered a sanction of $25,000 against Mr. Turnbow. You referenced that, Justice Birdwell, and that's not what we're here about. We're here about post October 2, 2020 conduct that led to the second motion, and did he do anything that violated the cease and desist order to warrant any sanction, let alone a 10 times $10,000 sanction award?
Which begs a question, which is, on what basis are we to consider the past conduct as it's represented in the appendices that were attached to Appellee's brief?
It's certainly relevant to the severity of the sanction considered. The case law is clear that it's a stepping stone with respect to sanctions, so the court can consider past sanctions and conduct, but you can't re-sanction for the same conduct.
I'm asking that as a record question. Are the appendices in the record for purposes of our consideration?
No, most of it. And we were honest with the court. We filed the prior sanctions order and some of the prior sanctions material. It's not, there was no trying to hide the ball with respect that there was prior conduct, there was a prior sanctions order, and that was dealt with in the October 2nd, 2020 order. But the stuff that's in the appendices that is not in the appellate record, we don't believe it's appropriate to consider, though the trial court is clearly able to say, well, I sanctioned my $25,000 last time and it didn't work, so they can step up the sanctions based on prior sanctions, but what they can't do is re-sanction for the same conduct. So all of the non-litigation-related emails that were the basis of that hearing that resulted in the October 2nd order have been dealt with. We're here on a follow-up order which listed four things, three lawsuits and one communication, after which the judge found 10 violations, multiplied it times 10, and that's why we're here. And we believe that the order itself on its face has problems. This court's decision in N. Ray Garcia and N. Ray EA, they're in our brief, say that in order to use inherent power, you have to make a finding of bad faith. It's ministerial. It's not waivable. It is a must finding from this court, and the Supreme Court in Brewer said the same. You must find that it substantially interfered with the core functions of the trial court with respect to hearing evidence, ruling on motions, and things like that. And so you have to have those two things as a bare minimum in a sanctions order. This has neither, and that's without even going into the record and determining whether or not there's evidence to support the 10 violations. But the order itself on its face doesn't pass muster and requires reversal. I see that my time has expired. If there are no other questions, I'll yield the podium.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Justices.
Thank you, Justices. May it please the court, my name is Joyce Lindauer. I'm the owner of the law firm that was the subject of a lot of what went on in front of Judge Allen's court. I will tell you, having suffered through dealing with Mr. Turnbow, that there was no abuse of discretion here. Judge Allen was fed up with what Mr. Turnbow was doing. He kept continually firing his lawyers. He went through, I don't know, probably four or five attorneys. Mr. Henry doesn't have the full history of what went on in the probate court, and quite frankly, I don't either. That probate dispute started long before I got involved representing Shayla Dunlap. The court asked some good questions. Let me clarify for you what's going on still in the probate court. On November 19th, 2021, there were scheduled depositions in connection with pending ancillary litigation in the probate court. A review of the record, if the court has an opportunity to look at the entire record, which we think you should, there were at least eight or nine ancillary matters filed in the probate court. This is in addition to just a routine probate proceeding. And so there were pending...
Again, that begs the question, how are we to look at the entire record?
Right.
On what basis can we look at appendices? Ordinarily, we can't look at appendices.
And Your Honor...
We're limited to the reporter's record. Right. We're limited to the clerk's record, and those appendices are in neither one of those.
No, I understand that, Your Honor, and I read their reply brief addressing that issue. One thing I would ask the court to consider, no surprise, since those appendices were attached to the appellee's brief, is that the court give us an opportunity to supplement the clerk's record to include the appendices that are attached to the brief. And so I think the court does have the ability to grant us...
You're making an oral motion to supplement the record.
Correct, Your Honor, to include...
Okay. We're not going to rule on that right now,
I understand,
but we
that.
Will recognize that as a motion.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I think out of, quite honestly, out of fairness, and I understand the issue because, as I mentioned, I did reread their reply brief, but by way of background... there were eight or nine ancillary matters that were pending in November of 2021. Some of those had been settled. Some of them had not been settled, and they were still being actively litigated. As counsel mentioned, there was a settlement agreement between Shayla Dunlap, Preston Turnbow, Trevor Turnbow, and Steve Turnbow. Shortly after that settlement agreement was reached in the fall of 2021.
I'm going to interrupt you again. Okay. You named a lot of people that don't include the two parties in front of us right now.
Well,
okay, and ordinarily final judgments have to deal with all the parties
right.
in probate matters with regard to a discrete phase. So what this order doesn't deal with any sanctions or anything else with regard to anybody but the two parties in front of us.
Understood.
So what is the order, what is the discrete phase that it's associated with that dealt with everybody?
Well, Your Honor, I tend to agree with you. I think there may be a jurisdictional question here about whether this, in fact, is a final order. And that's what I was kind of leading up to is and I don't want to disparage Mr. Henry, but again, he doesn't have the length of history with this case that some of the other attorneys involved have. And in fact, most of the conduct we complain about was at a time when he was not even counsel of record for Trevor Turnbow. Irrespective, what I was trying to explain is so the will in the probate proceeding has never actually been probated in the sense that the court has actually probated a will. That is actually set for hearing at the end of April this year to actually probate a will and determine the rights of an independent executor to move forward with that will. So that is still a pending matter before Judge Allen. We also have, unfortunately, two or three ancillary matters that have
Let me just clarify here. Where do we find that in the record?
Okay.
I
hear you.
I'm not saying it's not as you represent it
right.
to be, but I'm not in a position to be able to take what you tell me in oral argument
right.
unless he gets up and says, I agree with her.
Okay. Well, hopefully he'll say that in the reply because I think he understands the history here. But the other thing I wanted to point out, and a lot of these events have happened since this appeal was filed. So these are fairly new, setting of an April hearing to enter a will. There have been at least two new ancillary matters filed claiming breach of the settlement agreement from November against Trevor and his brother Preston. So what I'm telling you is there are still matters, significant matters, pending in the probate court. This is not a closed book. What the court should look at, and this you can look at, I believe, is we did appeal an order to you involving Steve Turnbow. And your court found that you didn't have jurisdiction on that appeal for similar reasons that we're discussing here today because that order, not unlike this order, the court concluded was, in fact, not a final appealable order. And you issued a decision on the Steve Turnbow matter about 9 months ago rejecting that appeal, saying there was a lack of jurisdiction. We even asked for reconsideration, and that was denied. So I've been down that road now on this case, and I think the jurisdiction issue is an important issue for you to consider. As far as the appendix goes, you have my request to supplement the court's record, but even without that supplementation, you have in front of you enough information to be able to decide, and I'm going to address the merit issue, which is to decide that, in fact, there was no abuse of discretion. That is the standard, is abuse of discretion by Judge Allen in awarding sanctions against Trevor Turnbow for the conduct that occurred not only, and what they're ignoring, not only the conduct that occurred in my office, in other courts, but the conduct that occurred in Judge Allen's court. And she says that. She says, you are wasting this court's time. Not only are you damaging the opposing parties and their counsel, you are wasting this court's time. What the record will reveal that supports these prior orders, which I think when you look at the question of sanctions, the case law is very clear that you have to examine the entire record, which would mean the prior orders. Now, what they didn't bring forward, and I do fault them on this, is they didn't bring forward the actual motions that relate to those orders. So they give you less than a complete record. Now, partly my fault. I should have designated additional contents for the record so that you would have the things that we included in the appendix. But had they brought forward the complete record, you would see the history of the abuse that went on here against my firm and my client.
Counselor,
Yes, sir.
Let me interject. I don't think you're going to have to prove to us that Mr. Turnbow did things that were not necessarily PC, if you will. I understand there's even in the record itself, there's specific instances where he was making sidebar comments that were inappropriate and things like that. But we're talking about the abuse of discretion. And one unique element to this is that the sanctions were ordered to be paid to your firm.
Correct.
And there's kind of an authority problem there, because sanctions in and of themselves are something that have scant authority. Is there authority that you are aware of, because I didn't see any from your brief necessarily, right, where a court can order sanctions to be paid directly to an opposing law firm?
Right. Well, Your Honor, I think in this sense, because the conduct was against our law firm.
I understand that fact.
Yeah,
I get
right,
that.
Right. I think that there is authority.
That's an argument, but do you have authority?
Right. Well, I think, Your Honor, I think if you look at some of the cases dealing with sanctions, and again, there's a distinction between fines and penalties and sanctions, right? So fines and penalties typically get paid to a court. Sanctions get paid to an opposing party, or in this instance, their counsel, who are the target, if you will,
but you
of the conduct.
But you don't see that $100,000 for attorney's fees that are around $7,000, and it's literally four times the original $25,000, which under Chapter 41 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code is the limit on exemplary damages, which are punishment.
Well, so, you know, Your Honor, I think that the judge was so frustrated with Mr. Turnbow having already entered a cease and desist order. You have that. Entered a first sanction order for $25,000, which he refused to pay, never has paid, never put the money in the court, never did anything with that. Those two orders, to the extent that they're final, there were no findings of facts requested. They were not appealed. Then by the time we got to the last hearing, I think, and if, honestly, there is a further motion pending in front of Judge Allen right now for an email that Mr. Turnbow sent our firm, which was disgusting. And we filed a further motion on that. But I think what the message she was sending was enough is enough. And I think because she knew how much that probate estate was worth, which it is worth millions. We're not talking a few hundred thousand. This estate is worth millions of dollars. Mr. Turnbow is entitled to a third of that estate, technically. So
plenty
I
of money. And I'm going to interject again. And we can sympathize
right.
with Judge Allen all day long. We can maybe even feel like she should have done more.
I feel like she should have done
more. But there has to be authority for
right.
it. And, you know, as appellate jurists, we have to have authority. I mean, one, we have jurisdictional issues about whether or not we should even be hearing this oral argument right now or even having looking this at on appeal. But beyond that, you know, ordering sanctions to not just opposing parties but to their actual counsel, you know, we need authority for that as well.
Right. Well, and I think, Your Honor,
I have a question
sure.
along those lines. Being a trial judge
right.
and holding, trying to keep the decorum in the courtroom, and you're seeing the progressive activity of the litigants not being deterred and following that decorum, that inferred a power or authority, the trial court, do you have any case law that allows a district or county judge or constitutional judge to craft a sanction in such a way to deter the egregious behavior? Now, also, is there anything that you can point into the record other than in the appendix, or was that developed on that hearing regarding those specifics in terms of that egregious behavior related to how the previous actions of the trial court was to develop a strategy to deter that erroneous or improper behavior by the litigant?
And if so, Judge Gonzalez may want to use it.
Okay.
Downstairs.
Well, you know, the case I'm looking at.
Well, down there you get to lock people up.
That's true.
Well, and that was one of the requests that was actually made.
I actually saw that.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, and right. she was one step away from that. But the case that I'm looking at is a case called N. Ray Bennett, Supreme Court case number 960598. And that case was actually a case directed at an attorney who had, in fact, been sanctioned for conduct in that case. Now, what you have here is a little different because you have a pro se party, but in essence, you have someone who is representing themselves. And in that particular case, the court said courts, of course, possess inherent power to discipline, in this case, attorneys' behavior, holding that trial courts have the power to sanction parties for abuse of the judicial process not covered by rule or statute, recognizing the inherent power of courts.
It appears both parties are agreed that this is an inherent authority sanction. Okay.
Right.
Let's assume all of the appendices are in and that record is there. You would agree that much of the evidence dealt with the new litigation that was initiated by Mr. Turnbow against you and others. I think at least one in federal court.
Right.
Okay. How are we to determine the propriety of the $100,000 if we find that she didn't have the jurisdiction to sanction over in someone else's jurisdiction?
Right.
Okay. Because there's no real attempt in this record, to the extent that we consider the appendices, for her to say, look, you know, I'm only limiting this to what's going on with regard to me.
Right.
Okay, so how are we to – there's no segregation, if you will, under the circumstances.
Yeah, I think what it boils down to, and I think counsel alluded to this also, was her determination that she found at least 10 violations. And, of course, there was no request made for findings of facts and conclusions of law from anybody.
But some of those violations arguably were violations that were related specifically to initiating litigation, which arguably took it outside of the cease and desist order.
Okay, so what I wrote...
There's no doubt he was creative. Let me just leave it at
that.
I understand that creation, that creativity, okay? The bottom line is he still has to be in violation of the actual language of the order for him to have done something sanctionable.
Okay, so tab 16 to our appendix, which they didn't, is part of the record, which was the original motion for contempt and sanctions, filed on March 8th of 2021. What it included were frivolous filings, okay, and she alluded to the fact that they were frivolous filings not in other, just other courts, but in her court. In fact, the court made the comment that you basically are clogging up my court system with frivolous filings, because he was filing his own pleadings also. So she had that in front of her to look at. But frivolous filings, unwarranted phone calls to my firm, those continued and were part of the March 8th, 2021 motion.
Okay.
Emails
in making a finding, let's assume a finding of unwarranted phone calls, okay? Again, how he appears to have been very careful in how he characterized what he was doing and giving himself effectively cover to make these communications. How is she determining that this phone call was not related to litigation in another court, but in turn was a violation because he's in my court and a violation of my order with regard to conduct in my court?
Well,
that's what I'm having difficulty with, is because it looks like this order is going over into other jurisdictions, and that's the difficulty here.
I hear you, and I think we did attach, and you do have it as part of the record, a copy of one phone message where, of course, he said, you need to review 18 U.S.C. Chapter 73. That was the phone message on March 2nd that he left at our firm. And actually, that was a phone call that he left. That was not the only phone call that he left. And what does 18 U.S.C. Chapter 73, which is a criminal section, have to do with any litigation that was pending? Nothing. Zero. And what it was is it was just a veiled threat is what he was doing. But he was publishing things on Yelp. He was publishing things on AVVO. He never stopped. He told the court he had stopped. But he never stopped doing the things.
Was he actually forbidden by the cease and desist to not post things on third-party or was it simply to not communicate with you or with other parties?
He was told not to post things, and he told the judge that he had taken things down, but I didn't even look today. I probably should. I don't think he ever took anything down. Everything was still there. And I know you appreciate how bad this was. I mean, he almost single-handedly shut our law firm down. 1,000 emails, posts on websites saying these are crummy lawyers. We're not even his lawyers, okay? I think Judge Allen had that whole history of hearing that multiple times in front of her, order after order after order, and I think she just said, enough, $25,000 didn't stop you. Maybe $100,000 will stop you.
But that's the question I have for you right
now.
In terms of what's before the court and the actions that the trial court undertook in reaching those conclusions,
right?
Do we need to review the underlying facts that she relied upon, or just simply her conclusion, is that sufficient?
I think on an abuse of discretion, y'all, you have to do is look at what she found. I don't think you have to go back and look at what she looked at. I think she was the one that heard the evidence and made the decision.
And so
put
not,
your trial court code on. You enter an order and you sanction someone, mm-hmm. okay, and it goes up on appeal. And again, abuse of discretion is a difficult standard. I mean, Judge Allen had the right to do exactly what she did. She said, enough is enough with this guy. 25 didn't stop you. Maybe 100 will stop you. And that's why when you look at sanctions, you have to look at the entire history of the relationship, not just what happened at this one instance. The fact that this was an ongoing pattern and he didn't stop. Now, I think your first issue is the right one, which I don't think, now thinking all through all this, that you have jurisdiction over this appeal at this point, because there are too many matters still pending in the probate court before this issue becomes relevant.
Is the issue that is being raised now, is that been preserved for subsequent review by the court in the event of a final review of the probate?
I would think so, because again, she hasn't even admitted a will to probate, and the
You're
way
conceding
she
conceding that point. Then.
Yeah, I think that the issue is still alive. Now, one thing they didn't tell you, which I think is also relevant, is that the money that was in the registry of the court and the money that was being held by the receiver has all been taken out and paid out. Now, it was paid to my client as part of a settlement that now they say isn't settled, but so there is no pot of funds in those accounts any longer. Those monies have been taken out. So when the judge said, we'll get paid out of, well, there's no money to get paid out of right now, out of what Mr. White was holding or the registry was holding. Those funds have been swept out. So there is going to still be a question about collection of any amount, whether it's $25,000 or $100,000 or $125,000. But irrespective, I do think, and y'all understand the facts of what happened. There's no mystery there. But I do think there may be a jurisdiction question just because of, go back and look at what happened on the other Turnbow matter, the Steve Turnbow case. You might want to go back and review that because, and a little different set of facts there, but the determination was that that was not a final order.
And you didn't brief that initially because you just didn't think about it.
Basically. I didn't think about it until y'all raised the question of jurisdiction. So. I've dealt with Mr. Henry now a couple of times on different matters. I think he's a very competent appellate attorney. I just assumed that if he was appealing, he thought the court had jurisdiction. So, you know, we just followed right along. But when you raise that issue and knowing the history of that other matter, it did occur to me that there probably is a problem there. So, anyway, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Give him two additional minutes on rebuttal, please.
Just to clean up on jurisdiction, the court sent out a final notice, final judgment notice, the clerk's office. I understand, as an appellate lawyer, that's not determinative of this court's jurisdiction, but that's my first signal that you better perk up and read everything. And because probate law is murky at best on probate proceedings, I will say, though, Ms. Lindauer briefed the issue. She responded to your letter, briefed it, and actually came up with a different reason than I had. I had a phase of proceeding in my response to this court's jurisdictional brief, and Ms. Lindauer says many times in her brief she believes this court has jurisdiction, and also used the final judgment on enforcement and collection of an order line of cases in her, and it's in the court's records. You can read it. So up until just now, Ms. Lindauer has not only briefed the case, but in writing said that this court has jurisdiction for a separate reason than I said it had jurisdiction. And my reason was because that was a separate phase of the proceeding. It has nothing to do with the will being admitted, nothing to do with the preservation of property, a cease and desist order with respect to contact between litigants and their lawyers that has run its course all the way through. And now, based on her representation, which I do agree with, that the rest of the money's been distributed out of the registry of the court, so there's nothing left to distribute, really does close the whole phase of the whole cease and desist and sanctions order.
Hang on just a second. What's your position with regard to her oral motion to supplement the record?
Well, first, problematic since I didn't get to respond to it. I mean, their brief has very little, if any, references to any record, reporters or clerk's record. So it's mainly to their tab. So I don't know about that stuff. So I don't want to burden this court, especially if you have jurisdictional questions, with additional briefing. Secondly, is because it's an extraordinary motion post-briefing, there need to be a reason why it's relevant. In other words, there need to be a showing that you need that information, and everything that continues to be talked about both in the brief and before this court is pre-10-2-2020 conduct that has already been sanctioned. So this court is aware of bad conduct that resulted in a sanction of $25,000 that was done. All I'm here on is anything that was in a motion for sanctions, which the case law says, including this case court's case law, that says the court's limited to what's in the sanctions motion. You can't surprise people at a sanctions hearing. Four instances of conduct alleged in their motion. Four. Three filings and one communication that allegedly violated the cease and desist. And the reporter's record from that hearing is all that matters for this court's determination of this sanctions order. And if you want the flavor of what happened, the basis of the $25,000, you've either already gotten it or it's in the briefing, because they cite the litany of things like office visits. No evidence of office visits post-1020. That was the first motion that he was sanctioned for. I mean, the spam, all the things that were talked about, shutting the office down with emails, all of that was pre-10-2-2020. So I just want the court to be aware of the timeline here, that has been dealt with. It can be considered for purposes of an additional sanction, but you have to get sanctionable conduct to give another sanction, first and foremost. And sorry, Justice.
No. I mean, it reminds me, Judge Gonzalez is a criminal judge. I have some criminal experience, of probation revocations in the criminal context, and what's alleged in the probation revocation motion, as opposed to other things that the person did or didn't do. But. Going back real quick to the jurisdictional components and what you said that opposing counsel said, you do concede that even if appellee and appellant stipulated that we had jurisdiction, if we don't have jurisdiction, it doesn't matter what y'all say.
Absolutely. Okay. You cannot stipulate to jurisdiction, and if this court determines that this isn't a discrete phase of the proceeding that is opened and closed, that is not, it's not statutorily based, I've conceded that as well, this court doesn't have jurisdiction over the appeal. All I was bringing up was the fact that up until today, both parties seem to have different reasons under the probate law, the exception to the one final judgment rule under which this court did have jurisdiction.
Counsel, let me ask you this. If we accept jurisdiction, find we have jurisdiction, we accept the premise of your appeal, and we vacate the order, okay? Is there something in the estate code that allows the judge to take into – at some point in time, there has to be some type of approval of attorney's fees with regard to the attorneys who have been dealing with the estate matters. Is that correct? Ordinarily, there's a claim for attorney's fees. Is that correct?
There can be, yes, sir, and there were in some of the ancillary proceedings below in this case.
Okay. And is that something that can be part of a discrete phase? You just seem to suggest that attorney's fees can be awarded per discrete phase.
In conjunction with an ancillary matter, and the case law is pretty clear that ancillary matters have their own phases. They're actually proceedings, so they have an A at the end or a B or a C. Those, when those close, attorney's fees or no, those have jurisdiction in and of themselves. So, yes.
Understood. I guess my question is this something that the judge can take into consideration later on with regard to final disposition of the estate?
Generally, the court could take consideration on granting attorney's fees with respect to who incurred them and who caused the attorney's fees to be incurred if there was an exceptional amount. In this case, all of the issues between Ms. Dunlap, Ms. Lindauer's client, and my client have been resolved in writing, absent this sanctions order. So there will be no more allocations by Judge Allen with respect to my client. Okay. Absent this order to deal with. So we were left with the court's decision on this order, whether or not it was appropriate, whether or not it should be vacated. And I'll just, on the merits, Let me just say that the inherent power, if you read Brewer and the Supreme Court's decision in Brewer, inherent power is not only less discretionary, it is extremely cabined by that decision in Brewer. This court has said it is a ministerial duty that you have to find two things under inherent power in the order. Bad faith, meaning you didn't just violate something, you did it in bad faith, and it must affect the core functioning of the court. So when Ms. Lindauer says, the judge on the record says, well, you're filing stuff in my court. Nothing in this record of this motion for sanctions has anything to do with filing in Judge Allen's court. It was three separate suits and one communication. So she can talk about frustration, and I don't begrudge her that. But if you have a hearing on a motion for sanction that alleges bad conduct and you have a reporter's record, this court looks at the evidence presented at that hearing, matches it up with the motion for sanctions, and then looks at the order. The order doesn't comply with the court's rules, this court's rules, let alone the Supreme Court's rules on inherent power orders. It should be vacated for that reason alone.
She was not asked to take notice of her file. Judicial notice of her file, was she?
I think she was.
She was.
And of course, that doesn't mean the facts proof in the file, but the fact that those things had happened, she has knowledge of them and could take judicial notice, and I think she did, in fact, take notice of what had occurred.
That would mean she could take notice of a previous motion for sanctions, the evidence that was attached to that motion, because that's in her file, and how she disposed of that original motion. She could take judicial notice of all of those things, correct?
And she can just be aware of it in her mind because the case law says that judges can take into consideration prior sanctions when determining the severity of the sanction, but not, of course, whether to sanction. So you don't. It's not like I can go file a new motion for sanctions today against Trevor Turnbow, present no evidence, argue about everything he's done in the past, and get a new sanctions order. There has to be a new motion, a new allegation, new evidence of new conduct, and that all has to be borne out by the record. And so while understandably frustrated, this order doesn't comply with the inherent power rules, and the evidence doesn't support, other than the filings, which I think your honors have dealt with, there was no Chapter 9, Chapter 13, which have specific rules. And, in fact, those rules actually prohibit fines being paid to the other side at all, let alone their lawyers. There's literally no authority for that. In this court, every time it's been faced with a contempt fine, it's not contempt, but it's a penalty, not a restitutionary sanction, has said you can't pay it to the other side.
Okay.
You can't pay it to the other side. So we believe that also, just on a base level, is also. So, Your Honors, we ask the court to vacate this sanctions order, which would end not only this phase, but the entire phase of the proceeding between Mr. Turnbow, my client, and Ms. Dunlap in this probate case, and based on the briefs and the arguments today.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The matter is submitted. We will stand adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.